Welcome to the September 1st, 2026 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, with a quick summary of the new articles you'll find if you go to annals.org. I'll start with the update of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and Department of Defense Obesity Management Guideline. The recommendations emphasize assessing health risk beyond body mass index alone, using comprehensive lifestyle intervention as the foundation of obesity care, and flexibly integrating medications, including GLP-1 receptor agonists, as well as bariatric procedures as appropriate for an individual patient's circumstances. To develop these recommendations, the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Defense convened a multidisciplinary panel of clinical stakeholders to review evidence published between April 2019 and January 2025. To evaluate the benefits, risks, patient preferences, and practical considerations of obesity's definition and management. The guideline developers conclude that obesity should be treated as a chronic disease, requiring longitudinal, flexible care pathways that improve access to treatment and support sustained health benefits over time. A lot of attention is given to maternal folic acid status at the time of conception and during pregnancy as a way to prevent neural tube defects. But associations of both maternal and paternal folate and vitamin B12 status have been unclear. The next article reports a prospective cohort study that aimed to quantify associations of parental vitamin B12 and red blood cell folate with offspring birth defects. Using data from the Shanghai preconception cohort, the researchers found that higher preconception parental vitamin B12 levels were associated with lower predicted prevalences of birth defects. For preconception maternal vitamin B12 levels from the lowest to the highest categories, prevalence of birth defects decreased from 49.6 to 16.2 per 1,000 pregnancies. Paternal vitamin B12 status showed a similar but attenuated pattern, 55.5 to 24.0 birth defects per 1,000 pregnancies. Preconception parental RBC folate showed imprecise patterns of association with birth defects. In summary, the study suggests that both maternal and paternal vitamin B12 and folate status should be considered. Hardly a week goes by without a new study of glucagon-like peptide 1 or GLP-1 receptor agonist, and this week is no different. Next is the report of a systematic evidence review evaluating the efficacy and safety of GLP-1 receptor agonists and co-agonists among adults with overweight or obesity who do not also have diabetes. The authors identified 38 randomized controlled trials, including over 25,000 participants. These trials show that GLP-1 receptor agonists demonstrate substantial weight loss in adults without diabetes, with an expanding range of therapeutic options, including oral and multi-agonist therapies. Greater weight reduction was observed with emerging multi-agonists, including amycretin and retatrutide. Gastrointestinal adverse events remained common, 76% of patients on GLP-1 receptor agonists versus 40% on placebo, but discontinuation due to adverse effects was only about 10% on GLP-1 receptor agonists versus about 3% on placebo, and serious adverse events were uncommon with no new safety signals identified. In conclusion, available evidence demonstrates that GLP-1 receptor agonists result in substantial weight loss in adults without diabetes with an expanding range of therapeutic options. Artificial intelligence is perhaps one of the most rapid implementations of technology in medicine to date. The American College of Physicians advocates that clinicians think of AI as augmented, not artificial intelligence, a tool that provides assistance to physicians and patients. Many guidelines for AI use in healthcare are emerging, but consensus has not yet been achieved on issues such as privacy, disclosure, and fairness. A new American College of Physicians ethics position paper proposes that ethical use of AI in healthcare requires that use is rooted in principles of medical ethics, clinical integrity, and physician-independent practical reasoning. Go to annals.org for the full position and accompanying rationale. There are also two new commentaries on AI. The first cautions clinicians who use AI to deliver a prognosis, especially a poor one, to consider whether the decisions we make as a result relegate our patients to the predicted outcome. The authors believe that the introduction of AI as a new element of self-reinforcement, which risks consigning future patients to the predicted fate. The second commentary notes that concise, confident statements such as, "A new study is out, here's what you need to know," has become one of the common ways physicians now encounter medical literature. The authors caution that while not always inaccurate, these summaries are often incomplete in ways that matter. And in the era of AI-assisted summarization, incomplete has never traveled faster or looked more authoritative. The authors argue that medicine has always required its practitioners to be not just consumers of conclusions, but skeptical interrogators of evidence, and this obligation does not dissolve because the language model delivers a pithy summary. Another commentary laments that the Liaison Committee for Medical Education, the independent accreditation body for U.S. medical schools, recently weakened the requirement that schools prepare future physicians to address inequities in health and healthcare. These revisions occurred in the setting of federal governmental efforts to dismantle diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in universities. The authors explain that these changes undermine physician training and jeopardize patient care. The last new article I'll mention is a commentary on the always controversial topic of breast cancer screening. The authors note that no screening program has been more aggressively promoted than breast cancer screening. Decades of campaigns have reinforced the same claim, screening saves lives. This belief has been institutionalized such that mammography serves as a prominent quality metric, effectively equating more screening with higher quality care. Yet the authors believe that the evidence supporting widespread breast cancer screening in contemporary practice warrants closer scrutiny. They explain that it is not screening that is responsible for improved breast cancer outcomes, but rather improved outcomes are due to a better understanding of tumor biology and more effective treatments. The authors conclude that breast cancer screening should incorporate a more forthright discussion of the trade-offs involved, similar to how we handle prostate cancer screening. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll go to annals.org for a closer look at some of the new articles I've mentioned. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.